During his time as president, Richard Nixon recorded more than 3,700 hours of White House conversations. They're part private discussions, part deliberations, part confessionals, and 100% unfiltered. This is Presidential Recordings, Season 2, The Nixon Presidency. We'll hear Richard Nixon's phone calls with congressional leaders and Supreme Court justices, his discussions after his 1972 landslide re-election win, and of course, we'll hear about Watergate and his resignation.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
Wyndham Hotels and Resorts makes travel possible for all. Whether it's the long haulers looking for a great cup of coffee, a roomier rest for the on a whim road trippers, or a place to make summer memories with the whole family. No matter who you are, where you're going, or why, with 24 trusted brands to choose from like La Quinta, Days Inn, and Super 8, your Wyndham is waiting. Get the lowest price at WyndhamHotels.com. Restrictions apply. Visit website for more details.
June 17th, 1972.
Good evening. We have a mystery story out of Washington. Five people have been arrested and charged with breaking into the headquarters of the Democratic National Committee in the middle of the night.
The Democratic National Committee is located in the Watergate office building. The burglars forced a stairwell door, then taped its latch open. The door, now part of police evidence, was noticed by one of the guards employed by the Watergate complex. At first, the police found nothing. Then they spied five men crouching behind some desks.
Few presidential scandals occupy a place in American culture like Watergate, when five burglars broke into the Democratic National Committee headquarters and set off a series of investigations that ultimately led to President Nixon's resignation. One of the most public of those was held in the U.S. Senate, and one of its major discoveries, the existence of a voice-activated recording system.
So you were employed on January 21st, 1969, and continue to be employed until March 14 of this year. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Mr. Butterfield, are you aware of the installation of any listening devices in the Oval Office of the President?
I was aware of listening devices. Yes, sir.
When were those devices placed in the Oval Office?
Approximately the summer of 1970, I cannot begin to recall the precise date. My guess, Mr. Thompson, is that the installation was made between, and this is a very rough guess, April or May of 1970 and perhaps the end of the summer or early fall 1970.
Are you aware of any devices that were installed in the executive office building office of the president?
Yes, sir, at that time.
Were they installed at the same time?
They were installed at the same time.
Could you tell us a little bit about how those devices worked, how they were activated, for example?
I don't have the technical knowledge, but I will tell you what I know about how those devices were triggered. They were installed, of course, for historical purposes, to record the president's business, and they were installed in his two offices, the Oval Office and the EOB office.
That exchange, on July 13, 1973, between Senate Committee Investigator Fred Thompson and Nixon's senior assistant Alexander Butterfield, blew the Watergate investigation wide open. Up until then, a White House recording system was only a rumor, but armed with Butterfield's admission, the committee's lead investigator, Sam Dash, zeroed in.
If either Mr. Dean, Mr. Haldeman, Mr. Ehrlichman, Mr. Colson had particular meetings in the Oval Office with the president on any particular dates that had been testified before this committee, there would be a tape recording with the president of that full conversation, would there not?
Yes, sir.
And if one were, therefore, to reconstruct the conversations at any particular date, what would be the best way to reconstruct those conversations, Mr. Butterfield, in the president's Oval Office?
Well, in the obvious manner, Mr. Dash. to obtain the tape and play it.
The committee would spend the next several months trying to get the White House recordings, including taking the then unprecedented step of suing the president in federal court. But that's a story for another podcast. First, a little history. We'll start on September 15th, 1972. That's when a federal grand jury indicted seven men in connection to the Watergate break-in. The charges were conspiracy, burglary, and violation of federal wiretapping laws. 4 months later, two of the men, G. Gordon Liddy and James McCord, were convicted on all charges. Four others, including E. Howard Hunt, had already pled guilty. The judge presiding over the case, John Sirica, had threatened all of them with long prison sentences unless they talked to prosecutors. A month after that, the U.S. Senate voted 77-0 to create a special committee to investigate the scandal. A month after that, Judge Sirica read a letter in open court from James McCord that confessed the existence of a wider conspiracy. On April 9th, White House counsel John Dean began talking to federal prosecutors, and the Watergate conspiracy started to unravel. 4 days later, on April 13th, President Nixon called his chief of staff, H.R. Haldeman. They talked about Jeb Magruder, who was deputy director of the president's 1972 reelection campaign. Days earlier, Magruder had admitted to lying under oath about the campaign's involvement in the Watergate break-in.
Analyzing this Dean thing and so forth, it's your view that Dean probably didn't know the time after the election they met what the truth really was. Is that right?
I don't think he knew for sure.
That's what he guessed it might be.
I think he guessed it. Well, we all guessed.
Didn't think he had any choice. Well, we didn't really, did we? We thought it was some screwballs. I mean, that was... In fact, if I thought about it at all, I'm afraid I didn't think enough about it, but remember, I said, oh, this is just nuts, you know, and of course, I didn't dream that Mitchell would do anything about it.
No, I'm talking about after the election, back at the beginning, I think that's right.
But I said, I mean, when we first heard about it.
Oh, yeah.
That's right. But when Dean had his conversation, oh, after the election, we all knew, yeah. I mean, we all had a pretty good idea, but I mean, right after in June, for example, when we first heard about it, and Dean had his meeting, I don't think any of us really thought that Mitchell could possibly be involved.
That's right.
Or Magruder, for that matter.
That's right.
I mean, we thought that these guys just went off on a caper.
Yep.
Well,
I'll tell you that. I've just listened to this Magruder tape. Putting the stuff
on. Yeah, tell me what you think of it.
It's all there. It's an extremely valuable thing to have, because he flatly says that he did it, and, you know, that he was, he says he's got a 100 to 125 years worth of jail sentence ahead of him on perjury alone, and he says, when I talk, I'm going to tell the truth, and
so he's going to get off the perjury.
Yep.
But that's what Ehrlichman told me, that he was going to talk, so that's that.
Now, if he had said he hasn't decided yet whether he's going to talk or say nothing, he might go the fifth, I suppose, and say nothing.
Yeah.
But it would appear that he's thought through and prepared for, and his lawyers are advising him to talk. And he says, when I talk, it won't in any way implicate Haldeman, and in absolutely no way implicate the president. And there was no involvement and no knowledge of either.
Well, in this respect, Bob, he is telling the truth.
But he says it will hang Mitchell.
What the hell do you think this? Of course, we'll see what Colson's latest vignette is. But
yeah, I was just going to say,
what in the name of God is this thing that he's brought in here at this point? I mean,
I don't know.
What's your guess, though? I mean, that's a curious thing.
I mean, just part of the game.
And almost making it up, though, Bob, because I don't...
He may be victimized on it. I'm not sure he's maybe...
By his lawyer.
Yeah, or somebody else. Or by the press. You know, that was my first impression, was that this was a press maneuver. You know, they call you and say, the other guy's stuff, you better...
Yeah.
Let's talk about it.
And so Magruder is going to, has already, he's talked, and he's given a statement. You see, this went so far that, but when you examine Chuck, he said he backed off the tape and then backed off the transcript.
That's right.
Well, God damn him, he shouldn't do that with you. I mean, really, not, I mean,
embellish.
Well, you know, the real problem is John. God damn, I feel for him.
Yep.
And, geez, if I were advising him, I'd advise him to come forward and say, gee, I've told the truth all along, but I take the responsibility for this thing, you know. I
mean, that's his way out.
He really ought to do that rather than go and hardline this damn thing. He says, I didn't know about it, I didn't approve it, but I take the responsibility for it. Right?
Yep. And they'd let him off. They'd say, well, you know, this great man was screwed up and ill-served by his people, and that's too bad.
That's right.
Obviously, he had other pressures on him, and, you know, one of those things.
But he really ought to do that. But who the hell can talk to John?
Well,
Moore is the only one, and I don't know whether he's got much influence anymore. Well, I think I'll get Moore in tomorrow and talk to him a little about that. I think that would be helpful.
I don't know.
Or is that bad? Yeah, I guess it's bad. I really ought to stay away from it, you know, because basically, it's just the consumption of time and the rest, but I really don't know what the hell did happen, you know. I don't really know, you know, and I feel for all these people. I'd like to do something to save them all, but there isn't a goddamn thing you can do, is there? Do you think of anything?
Nope,
I don't. I mean, you say, don't let Dean go, like John says. Well, for Christ's sake, we're going to leave, but somebody else is going to go. Isn't that it?
Yep. I think you're sure. I think you just cannot obscure the truth, the elementary truth. You've just got to, whatever it is, we've got to be prepared to live with it.
And we will live with it.
And
let me say, don't be too damn worried about it.
And we've got to live with that, too.
Don't be too damn concerned about it. Can they say Mitchell, the Attorney General, and the President's campaign manager?
It's going to be,
let me tell you, yes, that's tough.
Any tougher than Adams?
No. My God, Adams was Eisenhower's alter ego. He was with him with the heart attack. He was president, actually.
That's right.
You know, let's face it. And it was personal venality. And not just a caper. This is just a caper, you know, like your poll showed.
Yeah.
When is that poll going to run?
The approval thing is apparently is for Monday release. At least that's, you know, they jiggle them around. You never know for sure.
Well, I don't know but what you think, but I think that's a goddamn positive thing, considering the beating and battering we've taken in the news magazines and the rest. What do you think?
Excuse me. I agree. Considering what they make people think on the economy, which is the thing we know knocks things down, and which they say does.
It's really somewhat the Eisenhower syndrome, basically.
Nobody's holding you up.
When Eisenhower, you know, when he went down to about 48 or 49 in 58, when the economy went very bad, but it was much worse. I mean, basically, it was unemployment then, not inflation, but just unemployment. But he went down to 49%, and that was his lowest, and then came up again. But what held him up always was the fact that he thought he was the best guy to run the world.
Yep.
And that's the thing we've got to keep in our minds all the time. That's the thing where all this gobbledygook about my going out, you know, and being nice little baby old ladies and all the rest, you know, it has to be put in perspective. That I think, is good. But, Bob, it's marginal. I really think that's marginal. Or do you agree? I don't know. I mean, this is something that, you know, if you talk to John or Ray Price or I'm sure Sapphire, the rest, they'd say that's the most important thing in the world, you know, to be a warm, nice human being like we all know you. Well, goddammit, the press isn't going to print it, are they?
Nope.
And the television isn't going to cover it, are they?
Nope. Not
so?
Done.
So what do you do?
Occasional.
Just have a few events? Is that, don't you think so? Just a few events?
You just keep doing them. You know, as in the normal course, you don't go overboard, and you don't avoid opportunities when you got them.
Right. Make a few more. Go out in the country a little more. That I want to do.
Make as many as we can.
I think going out in the country is good. I mean, even though it doesn't affect the pool, it just lets the country see. Don't you agree?
Yep.
Right. Well, anyway, I'll be interested to see what Colson's latest gambit is.
Yeah.
Bye. Bye.
President Nixon and his chief of staff, Bob Haldeman, on April 13, 1973.
This episode is brought to you by ShipStation. If you run an e-commerce business, you know how much work it takes to produce something great while dealing with complicated shipping issues. That's why over 130,000 companies have turned to ShipStation, an innovative tool that allows you to focus less on shipping and more on building your brand. With ShipStation, you can manage orders, label printing, reporting, and customer service on one easy-to-use dashboard. You'll reduce warehouse costs with reliable enterprise solutions and save thousands on shipping costs with discounts up to 89% off. Plus, you can effortlessly import orders from everywhere you sell online. So, turn your shipping challenges into opportunities for growth. Go to ShipStation.com and use code POD to sign up for your free 60-day trial. That's ShipStation.com, code POD.
Later that same day, the president talked with Domestic Affairs Advisor John Ehrlichman.
Well, they have quite a tale of horrors to tell. The bit of information that they had was that Hunt has decided to tell all of the grand jury Monday at 2 that the way they put it, it's not conclusive, but my suspicion is that Bittman, his lawyer, made a deal with the government so that Bittman does not get caught in this obstruction of justice business.
Bittman, Hunt's lawyer?
Right. He will implicate the committee lawyers, Parkinson and O'Brien, as the bagmen and the transmitters of money through Hunt to the Cubans and through Hunt to Mrs. Hunt for other people and so on and so forth.
Why will Hunt do this, do they say?
They think simply because he has no incentive to stand mute now. He sees the whole thing going up in smoke, and he just doesn't want to be the only guy holding the bag.
I think
Bittman is the guy who's getting something out of it, and of course Hunt purges himself of contempt when he does this, so he gets a little something out of it, certainly.
This is at the committee, however.
No, this is at the grand jury.
I understand, but what he's at the grand jury, he's pissing on the committee.
Oh, yeah, sure. Now, all of this whole hour I just spent with these fellows was a Sink Mitchell operation.
Well, I hope you laid into him a little bit.
I did, and I have, for what it's worth, I have Coltsman's commitment that he will do nothing, say nothing, make no move without prior approval at this point.
What was our argument about Sinking Mitchell? I mean,
it isn't an argument. They recount a whole lot of details and circumstances here. There are apparently two other grand juries at work. The one that we know about in New York,
right,
which is very close to indicting Mitchell on something called Section 201, which involves his giving an appointment when he was Attorney General, seeing Vesco in consideration of a campaign contribution. They represent one of the witnesses, Danny Hofgren, who has testified in that case, so they're pretty well up on the progress of that, they say.
Right.
The second is here in Washington, where the grand jury was convened to indict a fellow named Klein for income tax evasion. And apparently, it comes out that he gave money to Mitchell, and they were not clear on whether it was supposed to be campaign contributions or what, in return for Klein getting government contracts.
Jesus Christ.
I can't either. But anyway, the grand jury thinks there's enough there that they're going along on it, and
that's
progress. Now, Liddy and Hunt had a conversation, according to Hunt. This fellow Shapiro has interviewed Hunt, and Hunt told him this.
Yeah.
Liddy and Hunt. Hunt says this is a screwball operation, this Watergate thing. I don't think I want to go forward with it. Liddy says, well, Howard, we have to. We can't call it off now. Mr. Mitchell has specifically instructed that we do, and we must go ahead. So this is who tells Hunt tells this. This is Hunt's
right.
testimony, and it's
yeah.
just a and so on and so
right.
it comes
right.
in.
Right.
Also, Hunt tells Shapiro, the reason Liddy is sitting there is, without saying anything, is he has a blood oath from Mitchell that he's going to get a presidential pardon. So,
Mitchell's never talked to me, of course, about it.
Right. But
never anybody.
That will also go in, you see. Now,
Mitchell, you think that, you know, he might have done it, though.
Well, I don't know. But in any event, that's what Hunt will say Liddy told him, you see. That's the problem. The thing, lots of thrashing around among Republicans. Next, they say the only thing you can do is beat this thing to the punch, and they have several suggestions.
Fire Dean.
Well, no, that's a minor aspect of this. All.
Yeah,
they hardly get to that. Incidentally, I read Coulson's long basic document, which was written before he knew that Hunt was coming, and that has Fire Dean and these other things in it. First thing Shapiro says is to restate very clearly that criminal conduct is not embraced within executive privilege. Never was intended to cover it.
Well, that isn't for me, but that's for somebody else to do that.
Yeah, but he means from here, the Justice Department.
Either you or,
Clintons could do that, but no act, no criminal act is within the scope and so on.
Right. I agree with that.
Secondly, someone, Coulson says me, Shapiro says Fred Fielding or somebody, but if somebody comes into you and lays out the damaging evidence, the U.S. attorney is given the damaging evidence by somebody in the president's behalf. Next, the president's man goes to see Gordon Liddy and says, Gordon, I don't know what you may have been promised, but obviously no one had authority to promise you a pardon. The only way you could be entitled to any consideration in a case of this kind would be by coming clean, by telling the truth. And the president very much wants you to tell the truth, always has wanted you to tell the truth, regardless
of... You have your...
Then, you have stolen a march on Hunt. You have broken the case by persuading Liddy to come clean. He's the key to the Watergate thing. The focus is all on Watergate with Liddy. And you have demonstrated your desire that it all come out.
That's their plan. Well, how does this all affect Coulson?
Well, I don't know how it all affects Coulson. Hunt has got to talk a lot about Coulson, I would guess. Well, one...
That's the other point. If he wants to keep Hunt silent.
One marginal piece of news that they brought in that has Coulson a little shook is that McCord has told the U.S. attorney that he participated in an operation with Hunt to go out to Las Vegas, leave their airplane with the engines going, standing by, go into town, bust Hank Greenspun's safe, steal some stuff from it, jump back in the airplane and come on back, and that Coulson masterminded it.
In the name of God, would that be?
I can't imagine. But Coulson stoutly and devoutly maintains that he never heard a thing about it. That never heard of it before. Never heard of Hank Greenspun before. So far.
Well, you see, you've got to analyze all of this, John, as you, of course, know, in terms of what Coulson and Shapiro are thinking of.
Sure.
But why don't you think it over a bit?
I will.
See where we go from here.
It's another Mitchell tubing. Their whole point is that sometime between now and 2 o'clock Monday afternoon, you have to sink Mitchell, and that every minute counts.
I have to sink Mitchell.
In order to detach yourself from it, because otherwise Hunt will have conclusively sunk him, and nothing you can do thereafter could get out ahead of it.
What do they say? In essence, Hunt is going to testify. Is that it?
Right.
When?
2 o'clock Monday.
Uh-huh. And on that occasion, he's going to say, watch. Let's run that over again with me, if you will.
He will tell about his conversation with Liddy, where Liddy said, we have to do this because Mitchell insists on it.
Right.
He will say Liddy told him that he shouldn't, Liddy wasn't going to testify because Mitchell was going to get him a presidential pardon. Participated.
How do we handle that, the presidential pardon thing? We just deny it.
Flat out deny it.
Vigorously, strong. Frankly, it's not only a flat out denial, it's totally true.
That's right.
Mitchell's never discussed the goddamn case with me.
Right.
Sure. The way he says, Mitchell says he's going to get a pardon. Well, that's Mitchell. Not that that's any comfort.
Spiro has an interesting line.
Yeah.
I said, what would you do if you were John Mitchell's attorney?
Yeah.
He said, very simple. He said, I'd do two things. First thing I'd do is try and stop the Irvin hearings. The second thing I would do is come in and try and prove insanity. He said, Mitchell shows all kinds of signs of mental deterioration.
Really?
And
like what?
Well, and he never got a hold of it, and he was confused and this and that and the other thing.
It never worked, but go ahead.
He said, you know, I'll bet I could find 20 witnesses who would come in and say the John Mitchell of today is different than the John Mitchell of 6 years
ago. Yeah, yeah, yeah. That won't work. What else? What was
that? That's it. That's all.
Oh, that won't work.
That's all.
Oh.
He says that Mitchell has to be aware of these other two grand juries going, and that is certainly adding to his mental confusion at the moment.
Mm-hmm. Well, actually, all that you said doesn't particularly change anything that we talked about this afternoon.
No, not really. Not really.
Except the
cumulative in many respects.
Well, except the amount thing. I don't know.
I think I had better let Dean know this in case he doesn't know it. Because this will change some of this aftermath business, I think. Because Hunt is an actor in that aftermath business.
I mean, that Dean then would say that he...
Well, I don't know if it would change his testimony any, but he certainly ought to be aware that it's happening.
Now, let me ask you to do this, and you check with Bob on it.
He's sitting right here.
You've got to figure what will... Put yourself in Magruder's and Mitchell's place. What are they going to do? Now, are they going to... Is Mitchell going to sit here and...
No, I don't mind.
So.
I don't think so.
What do you think they're going to do?
Come in.
Huh?
I think they'll come in to the U.S. Attorney. I think Magruder's ready now.
Come in and confess?
Sure.
Yeah. But what are they going to do? They're going to piss on the White House. That's what I'm worried
about.
Oh,
I see. I see.
What you going to say?
I don't think Magruder will. I think Higby sewed him... pretty tight on this telephone thing.
Yeah,
as far as Bob's concerned,
that's not evidence, of course.
He'll try and get Dean and Strawn into this, I think.
Higby will?
No.
I mean, Magruder will?
Yeah.
No. But you see, the telephone conversation is not evidence, John.
I understand, but it's a prior and consistent statement, and Higby's a witness, and he refreshes his recollection by a recorded conversation.
Which was illegal.
Well, sure, but nevertheless, it's basis for refreshment.
All right, fine. What does Mitchell say? What the hell is he doing? He doesn't want to hurt the president. That's for damn sure. This is a decent man.
Well, if I were Mitchell, I'd get on a plane and I'd come down here and ask to see you. And I'd come in and say, I've put this meeting off as long as I can. Now you've got to know what happened.
Right.
And it's up to you as to what I do from here.
You see, you can be very considerate about a former attorney general, you know.
Sure.
That's the point that he's got to realize. But goddamn, he may just decide to stronghold and fight it through. They've never written on that.
I can't see that he would. He's just
with Liddy hand and foot. With Liddy cracking, if Liddy cracks and Hunt cracks, what no Hunt's hearsay, though?
Well, he's hearsay on a lot of it. He's not hearsay on Coulson, and that may be a problem for us.
I really think Coulson is deeply concerned about Hunt, don't you?
I'm sure he is.
Or did you sense that from your meeting?
He had Hunt talk to Shapiro a long time.
Yeah.
The other day.
Yeah.
At that time, Hunt was of a frame of mind that he was not going to say anything.
Right. But now he is.
Now he is. And I think Bittman has brought him around.
Bittman, who is Hunt's attorney.
Right.
And I don't know.
President Nixon and White House Domestic Affairs Advisor John Ehrlichman from April 13, 1973. 2 days later, the president spoke with Assistant Attorney General Henry Peterson after getting word that White House Counsel John Dean had told the grand jury that Bob Haldeman had helped plan and cover up the Watergate break-in.
Anything further you want to report tonight before our meeting tomorrow at 12:30?
Anything especially that I didn't give you today.
Nothing that adds to what we had earlier.
That's right. They concluded the meeting with Dean.
Okay.
His counsel says he will not permit him to plead.
Permit him to plead? What do you mean by that?
To plead guilty. In other words, he'll go to trial.
He's got to plead not guilty, huh?
That's right, unless we come to some agreement with him. His counsel's position is that it would be a travesty to try Dean and not try Ehrlichman and Haldeman. But the basic information, to the extent that is developed in these preliminary negotiations, is much more than I gave you.
Well, let me ask you this. Based on this, though, you mean that inhibits you from using information then? Or do you use it, or how do you do it? You use it for leads, but you can't use it unless he pleads, right?
We cannot use it for any purpose unless he pleads.
For no purpose?
That's right. Unless he pleads, that's incorrect. Unless we strike some agreement with him. He had a call from Ehrlichman. Ehrlichman wanted to meet with him tonight at about 8 o'clock. We advised him he would have to make his own determination, but suggested he not.
I see.
He then, through his counsel, informed us that he was writing a note to you in which he would say, one, that what he was doing was in your best interest and that would all become apparent as the situation unfolded.
Right. Let me ask you this. Why don't I get him in now, if I can find him, and have a talk with him?
Any objection to that, Mr.
Is that all right with you?
Yes, sir.
All right. I'm going to get him over, because I'm not going to screw around with this thing, as I told you.
All right.
But I want to be sure you understand that, you know, we're going to get to the bottom of this thing.
I think the thing that...
What do you want me to say to him? Ask him to tell me the whole truth.
Yes, sir.
Right.
Yes, sir. And there's one other thing. That is that a signal from you might bring out the truth from Liddy.
From Liddy?
Yes.
Signal from me. What do I do?
Went to John Mitchell and indicated that I'm told that he would do whatever he was told to do.
I never met the man. I don't know what I could do with him.
Mm-hmm.
I give him a signal.
Well, it for you.
Liddy has talked to John Mitchell and sent a signal from the president?
No, he sent a signal from Mitchell.
From Mitchell?
Yes, sir. And Mitchell indicated that he was going to stand firm.
Then how do I, am I trying to get out, how do I get, you mean I then would go over Mitchell to Liddy?
Well, in effect,
you're telling me that?
So we just go and say that we've discussed the situation with the President of the United States, and he thinks it's vitally important that you tell us everything you know.
I get it. Okay. Now, you'll be through with your things, you think, by 12:30, right?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Well, get a good night's sleep, huh?
I will indeed.
As good as you can.
Yes, sir.
Okay.
All right. And you too.
Fine.
All right, sir.
After hearing about John Dean's admission, John Ehrlichman called Acting FBI Director Patrick Gray.
Pat, this is John Ehrlichman.
Yes, John. Good evening.
Did I find you at home?
Yes, I'm at home.
I wanted to tell you that John Dean has apparently decided to make a clean breast of things with the U.S. attorney. One of the questions that apparently they've been asking him is about the envelope that he turned over to you.
Yeah, well, he better deny that.
Well, he's apparently pretty much on the record on that. Thought I'd better alert you to it.
What the hell am I going to do about that?
I don't know. Is it still in being?
No.
I see. I don't know.
I was told that was purely political and I destroyed it.
I see. Okay. Well, it probably was.
Is there any way you can turn him off?
No. Hmm?
want to talk about?
Well, he's putting the best face on his relations with Peterson that he can. Peterson has sort of moved in on the prosecution.
Uh-huh. What, was he doing things with Peterson too?
Yeah. You might want to take a look at your whole card where he's concerned, because I don't know all the ins and outs of your relationship or, you know, what...
The only thing I can do with this is deny it.
Okay.
You're not going to back him up, are you?
I can say nothing about it except that what he told me. But he has spent all day today with the U.S. attorney. John Ehrlichman again. I've been giving some thought to our conversation. I just don't think there's any way to do anything but level on this if you're asked. There's just too many collateral facts. If it's the fact that that was just full of stuff irrelevant to any business of the Bureau, why, you know, that's reason enough.
Well, that's what I was told, but I didn't look at it, John.
Right. I just don't see how you get yourself crossways in the testimony in this thing for fear you get caught up in it.
Mm-hmm.
So I just encourage you to just state the facts.
I stated straight away, you know, that he at no time did he indicate this was from Hunt's material.
Yeah. Oh, I see. So you didn't know where it came from?
No.
See?
No.
Just that it was papers that he wanted to turn over to you?
Yeah.
I see.
That they're purely political things and had no bearing on the subject at all.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, I think if I were you, I'd stick to that. I obviously can't tell you what to do, but I was a little troubled by our conversation, and I didn't pick it up fast enough.
Mm-hmm.
You said that, so I just thought I'd better call you back.
Yeah, I don't know all the other collaterals there are that are involved in it.
It's moving so fast, I'm frank to confess I don't either, but I just hesitate to get crosswise on something of that kind.
Mm-hmm.
I'll talk to you later.
Okay.
Bye, Pat.
White House Domestic Affairs Advisor John Ehrlichman and Acting FBI Director Patrick Gray. Later that day, the president called Henry Peterson again. They talked about what John Dean knew and what would happen next.
Yes, sir, Mr. President.
Trying to reach Dean, I think I may be able to get him. I hope before he seems to be in transit from someplace to someplace. But I'll report to you after I see him.
Very good.
Anyway, in the meantime, on Liddy, I don't know the man, of course, and have no control over him, but help, you were to tell him the president wants everybody involved in this to everything they know. Okay?
Indeed, sir. I'll get in touch with his lawyer first thing in the morning.
I do it tonight.
Very good.
I want to fart around, okay?
Very good.
Don't you think that's the best thing to do?
Indeed, so.
Fine. But one thing I want to be sure is that Henry understands. As far as Liddy is concerned, I don't know. I have no control over him. I don't know the man at all. And I just want, but since he has raised the question that maybe, you know, not talking because of me.
I didn't leave that impression.
Because of Mitchell.
He's taking orders from higher authority.
Well, my God.
He's changing his mind that since you're the highest authority,
fine.
You know, he'll stay in line.
All right. You just
be handled discreetly.
I just want him to be sure to understand, as far as the president is concerned, everybody in this case is to talk and tell the truth. Now that you're to tell everybody, you don't even have to call me on that with anybody. You just say those are your orders.
Very good.
Fair enough?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
All right, thank you, sir.
Henry, I've been talking to John Dean and am quite finished, but he stepped out for a minute.
Sure.
I wanted to ask you this. He says that he thinks it's important that I tell Liddy's attorney, I don't know who he is by name, a Marillis, do you know him? That what I told you a few minutes ago, that he's...
So,
huh?
Yes, we're already trying to get in touch with him.
Let me say this. You tell him. If necessary, you haul his ass in here and I'll tell him, okay?
All right. Indeed, sir.
You know what I mean. You tell him that I have called you directly
President Nixon and Assistant Attorney General Henry Peterson on April 15, 1973. Next time on Presidential Recordings, more calls between President Nixon and his White House aides as the fallout from the Watergate scandal continues to grow. Thanks to NixonTapes.org, the Miller Center at the University of Virginia, and the Richard Nixon Presidential Library and Museum. Remember to follow Presidential Recordings so you never miss an episode.